4:15, this is Don Shelby, almost 4:16. On Wednesday E-Day, it's good to have you with us. Not too long ago, I did a story about an organization called Sartec, a company up in Anoka County, and was just overwhelmed by the technology that I saw there, the what is called the McGuyan process, and how the McGuyan process was developed. But basically, it can turn almost anything into perfect diesel, and they've got a plant up in Isanti, and I told you I'm a big algae supporter, and algae is just one of the feedstocks that you can put into the McGuyan process and end up with diesel, and you can cart the refinery, in essence, around to farms anywhere you want to go, or out to the pond, wherever the algae is, if you've got a way of harvesting that. Dr. Pete Gruhl is with us, and he is the general manager of Sartec. Dr. Mark Rasmussen is with us as well. He's all about algae. Good to have you with us, both of you.
Thanks, Don.
Okay, I want to say something. Is algae the future of diesel fuel?
We really think it is, because when you look at the other feedstocks, they've all got inherent constraints. But algae, the sky's the limit if we can figure out ways to grow it and grow it cost-effectively.
And can you grow it so it is not, this is a biological question, grow it so it is not contaminated by other kinds of algae that is not as good, so that the other algae take over what is the good algae from which you can get a lot of oil?
Well, that's a challenge, but we microbiologists think that we can control these kind of contamination effects. So we've got some ideas to work on, and it's got a ways to go, but we're working on it.
If you add 15,000 square miles of algae, this is at least one figure I heard. You can correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll get you in here on this, Doctor, if you would comment. But 15,000 square miles of algae would answer basically the diesel needs for the transportation sector in the United States. That's a big chunk. That's about a third of the state of Minnesota. But is that, Dr. Gruhl, is that correct?
Yeah, that's a theoretical number. So if
right.
you take high-yield algae, you know, producing at a certain rate and extrapolate that out, you can take that number and satisfy the demand for diesel by producing oil with the algae and converting it to biodiesel.
Now, how do you convert diesel? How do you convert algae, which everybody sees as pond scum and they don't want it anywhere near them? You can say, fine, I'll take it all, all you can grow. I'll take it away from you and we'll turn it into diesel. How do you make diesel fuel out of pond scum?
Well, algae contain a certain percentage of lipid or oil, and that oil can
so
be...
So we just, for the purposes of science, people at home, basically in biology, a lipid is an oil.
A fat or an oil.
Right.
Lipid is technically classified as anything that dissolves in a fat
okay.
or oil. So it can be a lot of things. But people use the term lipid to refer to fats and oils.
Okay.
Okay.
So they contain lots of fat. Where does it get fat? How does it get fat?
It produces it. And Mark can talk about that more than I can.
Okay.
But
as a microbiologist, let me go to Mark real quickly. How does algae get fat?
Well, algae are photosynthetic organisms. That is, they use the sun, and they use water, and they use carbon dioxide. And inorganic minerals like fertilizer material, nitrogen compounds and so forth, and that's what they can grow on.
And they get fat.
And they'll produce various cell constituents, one of those being lipids or fats.
Okay, now you squeeze that out. How do you squeeze it out?
You can mechanically get it out, or there's other routes you can take to get it out. You know, an algae float on water, right?
Right.
That's the reason they float on water. They have, just like oil floats on water,
right.
they have that oil in them. You get that oil out, and then you can use a process such as our new process, this McGuyan process, to chemically convert it into biodiesel. Now, raw algae oil is about 50% free fatty acid, which cannot be converted with the traditional process. You need a different type of process to convert it to biodiesel.
A big cracking chamber, you mean, like a refinery.
Well, a traditional biodiesel plant is like a batch process. You have a tank. You put your oil in it.
Some enzymes?
Typically not enzymes. You use a catalyst such as sodium hydroxide and alcohol such as methanol, and then you heat it up for a period of time, say 8 hours, and then the oil, the lipids are converted. The triglycerides in there are converted to biodiesel. The free fatty acids are not. And most of these feedstocks contain both triglycerides and free fatty acids. So the traditional process can really only convert the triglycerides to biodiesel. In our process, we can convert both triglycerides and free fatty acids to biodiesel.
Wow. Can you guys stick around for a little while? Talk a little bit more about the Mergayan process, about algae, and about all the feedstocks that Sartec is looking at right now?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Good deal. 423, Don Shelby with you right now on Wednesday, E-Day, Energy and the Environment. We're talking about Sartec and a new plant going up in Isanti, about ready to be unveiled. Dr. Pete Gruhl is with us, along with Dr. Mark Rasmussen, a bioengineer, I suppose, and of course, Pete is with Sartec up in Anoka. And this is a company that has designed a process to refine almost any kind of feedstock with any kind of fats or lipids in it that can turn it into a high-quality diesel fuel. And if you would, Pete, just give me 10 real quick examples of junk that you can make diesel out of.
You can use brown grease, which is, you know, trap grease, restaurant grease.
From the sewer?
You can just take sewer, that up? You know, coming from a water treatment plant or coming out of the drain.
That's got to be bad diesel that comes out of that stuff.
Now, that requires, it's a little bit more challenging to convert that. There's some other issues you have to deal with. But, yeah, we can do it. We've done it before.
Wow.
And yellow grease, restaurant grease. Tall oil, distiller's corn oil is a good example. That's a byproduct from the ethanol industry.
That they can't use.
Typically, it's fed to livestock right now,
right,
as part of the byproduct, and we can centrifuge that out, take that oil, and convert it into biodiesel.
Wow. Is the Isanti plant going to be operating primarily algae, or will it be multi-feedstock?
We've designed it with flexibility in mind, and first of all, we're going to be using distiller's corn oil. And additionally, we'll be using waste-free fatty acids from current biodiesel facilities.
So how much diesel can you produce at the Isanti plant over a year's period of time?
It will come online in the first quarter of 2009, and it'll produce 3 million gallons per year.
Wait a minute, just one place?
One place, yeah. What it's got the capacity to be expanded to 30 million gallons per year.
Based on how much feedstock you're able to get.
That's pretty much it.
So if you went, Mark, to algae, is there enough algae around to keep them in business?
No, that's where the cultivation and the productivity that we're working on in our research comes in.
So you're telling me if I had farmland, if I had a big chunk of lowland pond and I could get away with it and I had the Soil and Conservation Service on board, I could have algae growing out there in the pond, and I could just scrape it off and somehow get it into your hands, and they would go to Sartec and be turned into a biodiesel?
Potentially, but a lot of the algae that grows wild is pretty low in oil content.
Okay.
And so it might not pay for the harvesting, and that's where we're working on methods to grow higher oil content algae so that it makes the economics better.
Where would it be grown? Where would you find a place to grow enough algae to make a difference to the transportation system?
Oh, there's quite a few places. We're looking at potential. We're working with the power companies, GRE and Xcel, for soaking up some of their CO2 load that they emit, because CO2 is food to algae. And so it gives you kind of a win-win situation. So if we can set up facilities next door to their plants and use their CO2, then we can enhance the growth of algae.
I get it. So you're not talking about just pond scum. You're talking about basically gigantic test tubes that you're running the CO2, the captured CO2, into the test tubes with water.
With light.
And light, so that it can photosynthesize. And you can just grow algae all the time.
Yes. We're trying to. Our first experiments to try and grow it through the winter are happening right now. We're getting set up to try and continue to grow it, even up here in Minnesota. We're going to try and grow it through the winter.
So. This leads me to the next question. That is sequestration of CO2. Is that a viable way to sequester CO2?
People are looking at it from that standpoint. It's probably more a recycling of the CO2, so you use it over and over again, you would with terrestrial crops.
Right, so it'd be carbon neutral.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's taking as much CO2 in as it would give off, or how much ever has been given off before that is now taking it back down. So it's you're zeroing out. You're not adding any more CO2 to the atmosphere, and you're taking the amount in that will be released later.
Yes.
Okay.
But there's also algae that produce calcium carbonate or limestone in their growth process. And so then, again, it's a win-win, and there are people working on this where some of the growth is used for energy production, but some of it goes into limestone production, which is true carbon sequestration.
Got it. All right. Now, Pete, tell me a little bit about the, and we only have about a minute left, the short version of how, because it's remarkable to me, how you came about the Magaian process.
Well, the Magaian process, it started at Augsburg College. Undergraduate student Brian Cohn had an idea for a research project. He went to his advisor, who remembered that he had a student, Clayton McNeff, who dealt with metal oxides, and they needed some of this for their research project. So Arlen called up Clayton and got some of the material. They tried their project, and it didn't quite work right. But later on, Arlen and Clayton and another scientist, Dr. Ben Yan at Sartek, got together and came up with this idea for the Magaian process, which is a brand new way to produce biodiesel. Totally different from the traditional process. It involves a fixed bed reactor that houses a catalyst, and the reactants are pumped through it at a certain pressure and temperature, and what you get out the other end is biodiesel.
And it also creates alcohol, which you then recycle, and you also use the biodiesel to run the generator that supplies the electricity to run the refinery.
That's right. We have a pilot plant that we're doing that at, and you use an excess of alcohol in the reaction itself to drive the kinetics of the reaction, and that alcohol is recycled. It doesn't create alcohol. It's actually just being recycled back in.
All right. Is this something that the public can drive up and get a hold of, or are you down the road enough to say, we can go out to wherever you are and pick up your stuff, or we can bring the refinery to you? Tell me how that works.
All those avenues are being explored. You know, we have some engineers working on small-scale units for taking it to the farm, which is where we think we'll really be able to get into, you know, capturing carbon dioxide and recycling it. You know, and we've got contracts we're negotiating for feedstocks. If people are interested, they can sure check out our website.
What is it?
It's Sartec, SARTEC.com.
Well, I hope that everybody is listening today on Wednesday E-Day because, as far as I'm concerned, the name Sartec is going to be one day the equal of ConocoPhillips, or it's going to be the equal of Texaco or ExxonMobil. When they hear Sartec, it's going to be the thing of the future. And it's just amazing to me that you're coming up with all of these new ways of using biomass and waste products to create diesel fuels. And diesel may be the future for our transportation needs right now. And man, you've got to be proud to be on the front end of this.
Yeah, we're very excited right now.
I bet you are. Thank you very much for coming in, Mark, Pete. Good to see you.
Thanks, Don. It's our pleasure.
You bet. Welcome back, everyone. It's 4:47. This is Don Shelby on WCCO on Wednesday, E-Day, Energy and the Environment. We talk fairly often about recycling and how do we get people to recycle more. In fact, the state of Minnesota is pretty good about its recycling. And there is a new program out in Roseville called Get Caught Recycling. And it's a whole week that rewards unsuspecting local residents with $100 recycling their bottles, cans, and paper. And this is the 10th annual Get Caught Recycling Week, and it's sponsored by the Minnesota Beverage Association, the Minnesota Beer Wholesalers Association, with support from the City of Roseville and Eureka Recycling. And we're proud to say we have one of the winners of Getting Caught Recycling with us today, and that's Laura Bray. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And we also have the Honorable Craig Clousing, who is the mayor of Roseville. It's good to have you with us, sir.
It's nice to be here, Don. Thank you.
So where'd you come up with the idea?
It's something that has been done in a few other communities. We're always looking for ways to increase recycling. We have a very high participation as it is. About 75% of Roseville residents do curbside recycling right now.
Right.
You know, but we're interested in getting more people involved and rewarding that sort of behavior and making it the norm. And so it was something we thought we'd give it a shot.
What did you think about when they walked up to you and handed you $100?
It was fabulous. I was a little confused at the start because it was very early in the morning, but caught me off guard, and it was a great Monday morning surprise.
It was like the publisher's clearinghouse sweepstakes where they run up to you with balloons and big signs and a gigantic check.
It wasn't quite that dramatic, but they did have a $100 bill, and that was the best part about it.
But you are a recycler.
I am.
Yeah, and so you weren't looking for any reward. You didn't suddenly take this up and start recycling.
Nope, I've been recycling forever, so just happened to have it out that morning.
So why do you do it? Why do you recycle?
You know, I just feel like it's something I need to do my part. You know, it's great for the environment. And, you know, honestly, it's really easy in Roseville because they do curbside pickup and you don't have to wash things out or do a whole lot of sorting, so it's pretty simple.
So does Roseville handle its own recycling, or do you contract that out?
We contract that out with Eureka Recycling. We have an agreement with them, actually, where they share their profits with us. There's a lot of money in recycling. A lot of people, I don't think, are aware of that. And we use those proceeds to help pay for the program. In fact, we have just recently went to weekly recycling to enable people to recycle more frequently. So.
And that's recycling everything. That's cans, bottles, newspapers.
Correct.
What else do you recycle besides that?
Cans, bottles, newspapers. Some of the hard plastics we don't recycle. We are looking at some ways to increase recycling. Some of those things are a little more difficult to recycle.
When you say hard plastic, you talk about those that are colored containers.
Some of the containers,
like,
for example, plants come in.
Right.
Those sort of things.
I don't know where we're going on all of this recycling business, but eventually it seems to me that everything will get recycled. I saw the story we did last night on the WCCO. There is a big sculpture in Hennepin County that's made out of recycled guns that they have taken from people on the streets, and they've just made an entire sculpture out of the thing. I think there will come a day when everything we have will be made out of something else.
Mm-hmm. And actually, we have a couple events we do. We do a wild rice festival in the fall. And another festival where we try to have zero waste afterwards. We use biodegradable plates and napkins, and even the silverware is biodegradable. And then the food waste also gets recycled. And the goal is to have no waste after that event, so everything gets recycled.
Do you have landfill problems at all down there in terms of space?
We don't. We don't have there are no landfills in Roseville. But
right.
We do have an area where we compost leaves. The city is involved in a leaf pickup program, like the recycling program. Citizens can rake their leaves to the corner. We pick that up and take it to a composting area. It breaks down, and in the spring they come back and they can pick up some very nice composting for gardening in the spring.
See, it all makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. It just makes perfect sense. Did you do it because it made sense, or because you felt some political pressure? You felt some pressure because you're a young woman and this is your generation's issue, that you wanted to be part of sort of a cleaner society, a recycling society? What was pushing you to do this at the beginning, Ms. Bray?
I mean, I definitely think I do want to be part of a cleaner society, but I think for my generation, I've been recycling forever. I was doing it when I lived with my parents, and that was just something that, you know, it was logical for me to continue that. It was never really a question for me. It was just, that's what you do. You recycle things. It's just as easy as throwing it in the garbage.
Did Mom and Dad recycle, or was it something you had to kind of oomph them along on and say, no, hey, don't throw that in the trash, and you go there and you pick up?
I think my dad was a pretty good recycler, actually, and at that point we had to sort everything out into many different bins, and I remember having to ask him and sometimes leave things on the counter to make sure they got in the right bin. So I don't think there's really been any pressure. I just think it's sort of was an obvious choice for me.
Now, what's the other choice that one has to make when you go shopping?
Mm-hmm.
Do you look at packaging? Do you look at what something comes in? Do you look at what that's the other side of recycling, mm-hmm. is the purchasing part.
Right.
We have to bring that which has to be recycled into our home. And more products are coming on the market that have taken great attention to detail on the packaging.
Mm-hmm.
Do you look at that too?
Definitely. I think if there was, you know, equal products and one was in eco-friendly packaging, I would choose the one with eco-friendly packaging.
All right. Now, let me get to Mayor Clausing. Now, give me the reason why, from a public policy perspective, that the city is doing this. Should it be great stewards of the earth, or is there some intelligent investment in money savings? What is the public policy issue that you're trying to support?
It's both. I mean, to be good stewards of the earth, we want to pay attention to the environment, and our citizens demand that. We just finished a visioning process within the last year. We gathered citizens together, talked about where they wanted to see the community be in the future, and one of the things they came back to a lot was environmental stewardship and what are we doing as a community to pay attention to our environment. Also, there's an economic side to it. I mentioned the leaf recycling earlier.
Right, sure.
You know, those would be leaves if those were just left and people kind of swept them into the gutter or whatever.
Right.
We'd have to go out, pull those out, clear the storm sewer system out so it operates more effectively. It actually saves us money to do that. There's tremendous savings in recycled paper. You know, it takes much less energy to produce. It uses less water. It's less expensive. And so there's an economic component to it as well. But I think for the city's standpoint, we do it because it's what our citizens expect and what they really demanded of us.
I kind of like the idea. I say this over and over again, but to take one can of pop that is going to be recycled, requires 90% less energy to make a new can of pop than if you were going out and making it out of some aluminum ingot. Mm-hmm. And it's just that alone, just may say, let's recycle, because it just makes so much great sense. Ms. Bray, thank you very much for being with us. Mark Clausing, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.